Okay, we're up to the very end of 118. Now, really, if you follow, if you follow Rabbi Artscroll, and he said that you were upsold at the end of the previous blessing, so that means you're finished. You finished the Shema Esrei. That's why you say you were upsold. The difference is that now, if anything happens that needs an answer, you can answer. Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu. Because you said the first Yidrotzon. You have Yidrotzon signals that the Shemoneh Esrei is over. So this is a meditation or prayer after the Shemoneh Esrei is over. Now, the order of matters here, which we will explain, the order is, first of all, a prayer for appropriate speech, then humility, then Torah, then mitzvos, and then protection from enemies. Speech, humility, Torah, mitzvos, protection. That order is crafted. It's well crafted. Crafted according to the ideas that are important to us. Important to the Torah to set up dependencies. Well, let me start with the first one for a moment, because here you have, I would call parentheses enclosing the whole Shemoneh Esrei. I skipped at the beginning, now I'm going to put it in. If you look back on page 96, 98, 99, there is this introductory verse before the Shemoneh Esrei proper starts. My Lord, open my lips, and my mouth, they declare your praise. So that is a prayer for speech. In particular, the speech of the Shemoneh Esrei. At the end, the first thing you say is, please help me maintain the purity of my speech. That's what I think of these as parentheses around the whole Shemoneh Esrei. So let's see what these two indicate. The one at the beginning, on 99 or 98, my Lord, open my lips, that my mouth may declare your praise, says the power of speech should not be taken for granted. The power of speech is not innate to a person. Really, nothing's innate, but here we're stressing it about speech. Speech is a divine gift. The biggest proof of it is Bilam's donkey, which indicates that when God wants a donkey to speak, a donkey could also speak. We just take speech so much for granted, we don't stop to realize that every time we speak, we're exercising a divine gift. But it's more than that. What makes us human? Where would the essence of our humanity be located? Here, the Maharal, based on the verses in Genesis, Bereshis, when God creates man, it says, "Vayihi nefesh chaya," he became a living soul. And the famous translation of Unklus says, "The ruach mamahala." A speaking spirit. The Torah says a living soul, Unklus translates a speaking spirit. Says the Maharal, the essence of man is speech. Not thought, as the Greeks taught, that what makes man special is that he's rational. The power of logic. The power of thinking. No, what makes man special is speech. What's the difference? After all, speech is the expression of thought. That's what speech is. I'm not talking about howling in pain now, or if you're familiar with screaming in pleasure when the New England Patriots win the Super Bowl. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about speech. To use words is to express thought. Says Maharam, what is crucial is that speech is a bridge between the spiritual and the physical. Thought is located in the spiritual. Speech bridges the spiritual to the physical. And that is what is unique about the human being. That is the human being's essence. That is the human being's job, to bring spiritual into the physical. That's true. Not only speech does this, writing does it as well. And writing probably has the same character. It's very interesting that in halacha, you know that in the morning you have blessings on the Torah. Strictly speaking, before you study any Torah, you should say those blessings. There are poskim who hold that if you just think Torah, you don't have to make the blessings. But if you speak Torah, or you write Torah, then you have to make the blessings. You're not allowed to do that before you make the blessings. Why? Because merely thought Torah, as good as it is, doesn't express what man is supposed to be doing in this world. He's supposed to be bringing the spiritual into the physical. And if he's just thinking it, it doesn't have that physical expression. When he speaks it or he writes it, he gives it that physical expression. Just one more level, and I'll take your questions. Really, since our world includes this physical realm, an item is not fully real until it is expressed all the way down into our physical world. If an item remains only above, it's not fully real. That's why the importance of angels is that they engineer things to happen in this world. They're not just floating up there. If they didn't engineer things to happen in this world, they wouldn't be real. And all of the worlds of the Kabbalah, whatever they are, different levels, spheros, whatever you call them, all those levels, they all have their reality because they are aimed at accomplishing some change or some status in this world. So something that remains above, it does not get expressed in this world, is not fully real. To bring the spiritual into this world is the essence of the human being and the job of the human being. I think this finds, perhaps trivial, but homely expression in the custom that some people have, that if you want to remember something, you tie a string around your finger. Now if you think about it, this custom is very peculiar. I'm going to call it a custom. It's just something that people do. Because if I have to remember to buy milk on the way home, I tie a string on my finger. And after I remember to return the book to the library, I tie a string on my finger. And if I have to remember to get a haircut, I tie a string around my finger. It's the same string. It's the same string no matter what I have to remember. That's a little funny. You know, I'm not writing notes to myself where each note is written differently so I remember what it is. And it works. Even though it's the same string for each thing you have to remember, it works. Indeed, if you have some kind of memo technology, I have a palm, I find that if I write myself a note, 9 times out of 10, I'll remember it before the palm rings. Since I wrote the note, I'll remember it. If I don't write the note, I won't remember it. Why? Because when you write the note, or when you tie the string, you've taken the thought and put it into something physical. You've given it its full expression. Now there are examples in the prophets. A number of occasions, God says to a prophet, such and such is going to happen. Do the following symbolic action. And there's one occasion where God said, this and this is going to happen. Do the action. The prophet did half the action. And God says, only half is going to happen. Because even God's announcement of the future, in that case, depended on the prophet making it real by putting it into the physical world. And the Baal Shem Tov says, there's a verse in the Song of Songs, don't awaken love until the full desire is there. And he takes the as follows, when there's an awakening of love, put it into a chetet. Put it into something physical. You have a sudden inspiration to do a mitzvah, do something on that account. You have an inspiration to learn later, take the sefer off the shelf and put it on the table. You did something. You didn't just think it. If you think it and let that inspiration pass, it could disappear. If you do something on that basis, you have much more tendency to remain. So this is what's essential about the human being. And he takes the spiritual and puts it into the physical. That's what speech does. That's an indication of why speech cannot be taken for granted. And that's why, opening this right essay, we ask God for the power of speech. Yeah.
I only have two questions. You said how, time, that kind of thing, is taking, spiritual things and putting them to its full potential. I thought I always learned that when you put spiritual things into physical things, it's actually limiting, the spirituality. Like, when the soul is put into the goof, the soul is limited. And also, based on what you said, would you say that, when we say a bracha on eating something, rather than making that physical act spiritual, rather than the physical becoming spiritual, it's something spiritual becoming physical?
Yeah, I think there's an ambiguity here in the words. If you would take a spiritual thing and fully clothe it in something spiritual, limit it to physical, and limit it to the thing, then you would definitely be reducing it. You would definitely be reducing it. I'm not talking about that now. I'm talking about expressing it. Not limiting it, but expressing it. The same spiritual thing can be expressed over and over again in different physical things. Not limited to the one physical thing that I put it into. Right? And on the other hand, if you don't express it physically, then it has a great potential which is not being used. Now, the truth is, the two things that we're talking about, both are true. I'll give you an analogy. It's in my realm, and you have it in the deepest form all over and over and over again. You can't look at the sun. The sun will blind you. But if you take a smoked glass and put it in between, then you can look at the sun. Now let's think. When you put the smoked glass in between and then look through it at the sun, are you getting more sun or less sun?
Less.
Well, but without the smoked glass, you can't look at it at all. So then you get zero. So what you have here is a reduction and an increase simultaneously. You reduce the power of the sun to the point where you can take it and then you get it. That's why in the book they talk about this, they talk about a simultaneous hiding and revealing. The very hiding is itself a reveal. Because only when it is partially hidden can it be revealed to you at all. If it were something revealed, you wouldn't be able to interact with it. So here also, that spiritual, in full strength, if the soul were not reduced in order to express itself in the body, then it couldn't relate to the body at all. It couldn't relate to this world at all. But if so, then it wouldn't be doing its job. Its job is to transform the physical. So it has to be reduced in order to have an impact. If you don't reduce it, it has zero impact. When you reduce it, it has a 50% impact. But that's bigger than a zero impact. So it's a reduction and an increase going down simultaneously. Interesting, tricky point. Okay, we're together now?
Okay. Do you mind defining spirituality?
Yeah, I might. let me just insert two remarks about definitions. Number one, if you define a word, you're going to define it in other words, right?
Yeah.
No, So if so, and somebody's really hot on definitions, he might ask you to define those words. And then where are you going to go? To other words, which he will then ask you to define. It's got to come to an end someplace, right?
How about a description?
I don't mind, but that description is the words also. So at some point or other, you have to give up the demand for definitions. Right? Okay. That should just make you a little suspicious of this demand. Give you a definition. Because you can't press it always. Number one. Number two, let's suppose that we have a concept that we admit that we cannot define. What would follow from that? If you can't define it, so maybe you shouldn't use it? Shouldn't talk about it? You don't really understand it? That doesn't follow. That doesn't follow. In fact, very important concepts that we use all the time, we don't have definitions for. Here's an example. Truth. There's no accepted definition of truth. Philosophy has been debating this for thousands of years, and as of now, there's no agreed upon definition of truth. But, when your friend says to you that you never lent him the money, and you say you're a liar, you will not be amused if he says, "Oh, you say I'm a liar? Define truth. Can't define truth? Can't call me a liar." You will not be amused. Why? Because even though we don't have a definition of truth, in many areas of life, it's very clear how the concept should be used. It's very clear when it applies and when it doesn't apply. Yes, there are tricky cases. Tricky, difficult cases. But whether or not he borrowed the money is not one of them. That's not one of the tricky, difficult cases. So, we don't have a definition. Because we don't have a definition, there are some tricky, difficult cases that we can't decide. That doesn't mean you give up the concept. You just make sure that you use it only when it's clear. Don't use it for the tricky, difficult cases. That's the counsel of wisdom. And therefore, if somebody says, "I want a definition of X," you ought to ask him, "Why? Why do you want a definition of X? Where in our discussion have I used an unclear concept in the tricky and difficult cases, which are really controversial, and therefore I'm putting myself out on a limb, which I would have to back up with a definition?" If he can show you that you use the concept which has tricky and difficult cases, and you use it for one of the tricky and difficult cases, and your argument depends upon that, and you haven't got a definition, then his demand is justified. Otherwise, it's not justified. You cannot always stop the discussion and say, "Define your terms." If a person's on trial for perjury in court, no one is going to stop the trial by saying, "You're accusing him of perjury. Perjury means lying. Lying means not telling the truth. And you don't have a definition of truth." No one's going to be stopped by that. Well, so listen, the witness said he was in Chicago. We have eyewitnesses that he was in Houston. It's a lie. He perjured himself. And the fact that I don't have a definition of truth doesn't interest me or anybody else. So here, I'm talking about spirituality. I'm talking about the activity of the soul in respect to God, in respect to the creation of the universe. Right? My word spiritual is meant to cover that as a clear case, an obvious case. And if the word spiritual bothers somebody, just replace it with all those words that I just said. Okay? But beware of this. Don't let anybody stop you automatically by saying, "Define your terms." That's supposed to be the philosopher's battle cry. Well, it's a sorry philosopher who thinks he can rely on that battle cry. And I'm speaking as a philosopher, as a professional philosopher. Okay, now let's go to the end, 119. This is the other. In the beginning, we ask for the power of speech because we're going to speak. We're going to talk to God. Now, we say, "Guard my tongue from speaking from evil, and my lips from speaking deceitfully." Here the petition is against the negative. It doesn't say, "Help me speak well, rightly, purely." It says, "Help me be guarded against negative speech." Chofetz Chaim, in his introduction to his Sefer HaFetz Chaim on Lashon Hara, quotes a Zohar, a really disturbing Zohar. Zohar says the person who speaks Lashon Hara creates a cloud around himself. And then, when he speaks words of Torah, or words of prayer, they don't get through. The cloud captures them, and they don't get through. Speaking words like that cut him off. He can jabber the times of prayer, but the words don't get through. Because he's created a cloud of tumah, of defilement, which is a barrier to those words going up. So, here what we say is, Ribbono Shel Olam, I just got finished praying to you, and I want to go and learn Torah. I'm going to pray to you again later. Please help me keep my speech pure so that my praying and my Torah will not be in vain. They won't be worthless. This is a plea that my words be free from barriers to be able to go up. Now, so that's about speech. That's the other half of the parentheses coming at the end of the Answer. Now we ask for humility. To those that curse me, let my soul be silent. Okay, specialist question for experts. Why do I call this humility? Why do I call this humility? Anybody know an incident in the Torah which proves that this is humility? The Torah once says that Moses was the humblest of all men. Where did it say that? Where Miriam and Aaron speak against Moses. When they speak Lashon Hara against him, when they criticize him. And it says there that Moses was the humblest of all men. He would be the last one to respond. He wouldn't take up his own cause. Because he's the humblest of all men. So they spoke against him. So what? It's in direct response to their speaking against him that it said that he's the humblest of all men. So, to those that curse me, let my soul be silent. Let my soul be like dust to everyone. Open my heart to your Torah. That's because humility is the precondition for receiving Torah. The order here is planned. Humility is the precondition for receiving Torah. Torah is compared in many verses in the Tanakh to water. Chazal say, what is the relationship between Torah and water? Water flows to the lowest point. Gravity pulls the water to the lowest point. So also, Torah flows to those who hold themselves low. Why was the Torah given on Mount Sinai? Because Sinai is the lowest of all the mountains. When God said, I'm going to give the Torah on its mountain, all the other mountains were clamoring to be chosen. Sinai didn't even ask. I'm so small, I'm not even a candidate. That's why Sinai was there. In the book of Numbers, there's a little passage which talks about certain travels. And the words are taken by the Gemara figuratively. One of them is Midbar Matana, from the wilderness to a place called Matana, which means gift. As I say, he who makes himself like a Midbar. Midbar is open. Hefker. Nothing's owned. Anybody can go there. Matana, gift. Then that person gets Torah as a gift. The relationship between humility and Torah is a deep and strong relationship. So here, we say, number one, enable me to be humble. And then, open my heart to your Torah. Because that's a precondition for Torah.
Yeah. Is there an explanation of why that's true?
It's a good question. He's exercising a point of logic here, which I've said to some of you, but I just remind you of it because it's quite important. The difference between a proof and an explanation. Remember, have I told you this already? Or no, this is an important piece of logic. Sometimes you can prove that something's true without explaining why it's true. And therefore, after the proof, it's relevant to ask, okay, now I see that it's true, but I don't know why it's true. Here's an example. Hot air rises, cold air sinks. Here's the proof. On a winter day, when it's warmer inside and colder outside, take a candle, light a candle, and open the front door just a slight crack. Hold the candle at the top of the crack, and you'll see that the flame points out. Hold the candle at the bottom of the crack, close to the floor, and the flame points in. Why? Because the hot air inside the room rises to go out, and the cold air outside sinks to come in. This is one of the things you do this with four-year-olds, you know, and then they see that, oh, look at that, up there's pointing in, over here's pointing in. Woo, that's amazing. Just amazing. So what have I proved? With this experiment, you can prove that the hot air rises and the cold air sinks. But why? Why does hot air go up and cold air go down? If I told you it was the opposite, you'd just as well believe me. There's no particular logic to it. The truth is, the cold air is denser, and the denser things go down, and the lighter and the more less dense things go up. That's why wood floats and so on. The whole thing. But that's not obvious from the experiment with the door. So when something is proved, you should ask yourself, okay, I see now that it must be true, but do I have any idea why it's true? And if not, continue to investigate. There's more to be understood. This comes out in mathematics and logic very often. You'll hear people, mathematicians, talk about beautiful proofs. Oh, that's it. I knew they were a little nuts. You know, a beautiful proof? Pictures are beautiful. Music is beautiful. But that's just chicken scratch on paper. No, a beautiful proof is one that it gives you insight into why the theorem is true. Then there are brutal, messy proofs which have 25 different sub-clauses and everything's taken apart and done separately. Just, you know, in the end, yeah, you covered all the bases. Yeah, it came out to be correct. But you get no insight as to why it's that way, how it works, what the basic concepts are. You could never apply what you learn from this proof to some other proof because it's a mess. That's the difference. Okay, that's why he asked for an explanation. Well, I can give you a little bit. This takes us a little bit of field, but it's interesting material in and of itself. The Torah says, the Talmud says that Moses went up to heaven to get the Torah, and the angel said to God, don't give it to them. Don't give it to them. They're going to mess up. Give it to us. We'll keep it much better. What do they care? Because keeping the Torah is what brings God's energy into the world. And when that energy comes into the world, everyone benefits. And if that energy is blocked, everyone loses. So the angels say, it's not fair. You're going to give it to them. They're going to mess up, and we're going to suffer. Give it to us. We'll do it much better, and everybody will benefit. So God says to Moses, answer them. And Moses says, they'll burn me up with their fire. God says, take hold of the throne of glory and answer them. So Moses grabs hold of the throne of glory, and he says to them, let's see what's written in the Torah. It says there, honor your father and mother. Do you have fathers and mothers? No? So how are you going to do that? It says, don't be jealous of others. Are you have jealousy among you that you have to worry about that? It says, remember, you were slaves in Egypt. Were you slaves in Egypt? So, well, look at what's written in it. You know, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't apply to you. Oh, the angels were overjoyed with those answers. They made peace with him, and they all gave him gifts. That's how we got the term. Now, this story needs a little investigation. What? The angels were taking it blind? They didn't know what was written in it? I suppose you could say that, but it's a little funny. And then Moses gives the answer, so why are they happy? Why do they accept it at all? So what? And why are they giving gifts? And here's one way to explain it. Yes, they knew what was written in it. But the words of the Torah can come true, can be fulfilled, can be acted out on different levels. And each level they'll be true on the way that's appropriate for that level. I'll give you two examples, two simple examples that we can appreciate in our world. There's a verse in Deuteronomy that says, you shall circumcise the foreskin of your heart. Now, as a matter of medical fact, your heart is enclosed in a membrane. There's a physical sheath enclosing the heart. Still, that verse is not commanding surgery. They should go in, do open heart surgery, and cut out that sheath. So you say, no, it's meant emotionally, you know, it's meant spiritually. Don't have bad motivation, you know, so forth and so on. Correct. That verse is meant spiritually. And you can fulfill that verse, although the words are physical words, you can fulfill it on a spiritual level, and the verse comes true on that level. Similarly, and one step further in the analogy, all the instructions for making the tabernacle. The Sforno says that building the tabernacle was only a result of the golden calf. Had we not constructed the golden calf, there would not have been a physical tabernacle. No, but then what happens to all those verses? All those verses are part of the Torah. So, I don't remember if someone actually says this, but the answer is that all of those verses will come true in a spiritual way, just like the verse in Deuteronomy comes true in a spiritual way. Gold is one kind of intention, and silver is a certain kind of emotion. Copper, the woven tapestries are intertwining of feelings and ideas, and you can work the whole thing out spiritually rather than physically. The verses don't go to waste. They just become true in a different way. Now the angels say to Moses, we want the Torah, and we'll make it true our way, on our way. Let's take honoring your parents. How could an angel have a parent? Well, let's see. Each angel is created to do a particular job. Each angel expresses a principle. Now, in logic, you have relationships between principles. You have axioms and theorems. You can have an argument with two premises and a conclusion. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, says Aristotle, Socrates is mortal. Now imagine principles arranged in a hierarchy. And imagine you have a principle which really is a consequence of two other principles. Then you could speak of the two others as the parents and this as the offspring. Indeed, in logic, you talk about generating theorems. Generating. Comes from generations, things like that, right? So now, maybe, honoring parents for angels will be, you're created to operate on this principle. Make sure that when you operate on this principle, you don't go beyond the bounds of the principles from which you follow. Something like that. So, the angel said, you know very well, Moses, that the Torah can be true on many different levels. We want it, And we'll make it to an island. Good. So that's so, then what is Moses' answer? Moses' answer is, did you have parents? Were you slaves in Egypt? Do you have envy of one another? But Moses' answer is, he says, you're right. It could be true on your level. But God wants it to be true all the way down. He doesn't want it to be cut off. He wants the Torah to saturate the whole of the creation. All the way down to the bottom. And Moses says, we're at the bottom. You aren't at the bottom. The only way for the Torah to saturate the whole of the creation is to have it realized at the bottom. And we're at the bottom. And that's why they were so happy with his answer. Because he's saying, you're too high to be the appropriate destination for the Torah. The Torah has to go to the low, not to the high. You're too high to that. So they took it. That wasn't a misrepresentation. It's correct. It's correct. In their inherent being, they have much greater sanctity, much greater purity than we have. So now, having given you this whole long explanation, you see that the Torah has to flow to the bottom. And in terms of one aspect of humanity, the person who's humble, the person who gives himself no credit, in that respect, puts himself at the bottom. Okay. Now, having asked for our hearts to be open to Torah, then we ask for the courage, the strength, the inspiration to run after mitzvahs. Wait a second here. What? I never noticed that. What did that mean? Uve mitzvosecha tidof nashi? Mirdof be? Just realizing that's very strange. Nidof means to pursue. Nashi is my soul. Mitzvosecha are your commandments. But the particle that joins them isn't the right particle. It doesn't say, it's not a direct object, then it would be ve'es mitzvosecha tzedof nashi. Maybe it could say, limitzvosecha to your mitzvos. Be'mitzvosecha means, yeah, nidof, bit. I don't recognize such a phraseology. I could make up a shot, but I'm just realizing that I don't understand what it means. I don't remember any such phraseology. So simply, I suppose it means, I don't know what the biz is doing there, the base is doing there, my soul shall pursue your commandments. I could translate it in the English. If I would be a little creative, I would say, as my soul is chasing, whatever it's chasing, it should do so through your commandments. Your commandments should be the way in which my soul chases in the world. But at any rate, whatever the poetry means here, after opening my heart to your Torah, then I want the inspiration to be involved in the commandments. So this is what we said a few days ago, that it's Torah and mitzvot. Torah first and mitzvot second. And now, we can say, all those who are thinking about me evil, planning to do me evil, uproot their counsel and spoil their thoughts. After I've purified my speech, and I've achieved humility, and my heart has been opened to the Torah, and I'm pursuing God's commandments, then I can say to God, given that I'm this kind of a person, I hope that I'm the kind of person it's worthy of you, you feel appropriate, you feel would be appropriate to invest in and protect me from my enemies. And the order here is, you know, open, obvious. Yeah? Now, Do for the sake of your name, do for the sake of your right hand, do for the sake of your holiness, do for the sake of your Torah. I have to tell you that we Sfardim reversed the last two. We put Torah before holiness. I can explain our way of doing it, but you who are in the tiny minority, I'll remind you, because the whole real Sephardi world does it one, the other way, and I see them do it the other way, and just to hold out Ashkenazim, remain with this matter here. Let me explain to you how this works. I think this goes from external to internal. Your name is how you are perceived by others. Your name is something like your reputation. That's very external. Your right arm is your power of action. Both your Torah and your holiness are more internal than that. God's Torah is roughly his thoughts, his commandments, his goals. His holiness is something or other. I told you I don't understand, really understand holiness. Maybe Torah is the sum total of all of his commandments and thoughts and plans and priorities and the rest. And holiness is his ultimate goal or something like that. Whatever it is. Now, if we do it our way, Torah is third and holiness is fourth. This coincides with what I told you when we looked at the Shemoneh Esrei of Shabbos, and we saw that over there, commandments come first and Torah comes second, unlike all of the other references that I showed you. And I explained to you that commandments come first and Torah comes second over there. Why? Verse number two. Usually you put Torah first and commandments second, as we did here and in several other places. Torah first, commandments second. In the Shemoneh Esrei of Shabbos, it's the opposite. I'm giving it away now. Sanctify us with your commandments and give us our portion in Torah. There it's commandments first and Torah second, which is not the usual order. Why would the order there be reversed? What's the difference between the normal order and the order over there? What did I say? Anybody remember?
Okay. It was because you said that. When you put mitzvahs first, you're saying this is what is important to have. And the mitzvahs are more important to have than Torah, but when you want to get there, the best way to get there is to use Torah to get to mitzvahs.
90%. Yes, during the week, we are talking about strategy. Investment in Torah pays a double dividend. Number one, you have Torah. Number two, it leads to the forms of mitzvahs. Shabbos, we're not talking about strategy. We're talking about the goal. And we put mitzvos first. In particular, we say, sanctify us with your commandments, because the goal is to achieve sanctity through the commandments. That's the goal. And then, give us our portion in your Torah, because that is a great means to that goal. But Torah isn't the goal. Torah is also a means. The means is sanctity. The goal is sanctity. So Shabbos, we're talking about goals. That's why we put Torah first, mitzvahs first, and particularly the sanctity of mitzvahs first. So in the weekend, we're talking about strategies. And there, the rest of the Torah brings to that goal, to the goal of performance of mitzvahs. So our order over here is, do for the sake of your name, which is your reputation, that's very external. Do for the sake of the power of your action, which is closer in. Do for the sake of your Torah, which is God's thoughts, intentions, priorities, especially for us to understand, for us to carry out. And do for the sake of your holiness, which is the goal of the whole operation. To put your holiness before your Torah, making the Torah the epitome, is something which I can't understand. Now that's because I'm a chassid. I see things that chassidim do. You have to ask somebody else what the the Ashkenazi order? Betoken.
Yeah.
I don't understand why the right arm is more functional than the name.
The name is how a person is perceived by others. If I were the only person in the world, I wouldn't need a name. I know who I am. If I want to refer to myself, I want to think about myself, I don't need a name for myself to do that. Names are only useful when A wants to think about or talk about B. Right? So the name is really very extra. The name is how one is perceived by others. The power of action is something that you have for yourself. Only it's your power to express yourself in action. Right? That's more external to you than your thoughts are, than your values are. The person who, God forbid, is paralyzed hasn't lost his identity. And a person whose body is perfectly healthy, but whose mind is gone, has lost his identity. Right? Your thoughts and your feelings and your conceptions, your will, your goals are really much closer to your identity than your ability to act.
What does God's right hand say?
What do you mean?
Was
it say?
What does his right hand say? When you say that?
We're talking about his doing something. What goals or what values do we know that he has that we could appeal to and say, I know that you're committed to these things, this you should do it for. Now you're right. You're right to ask. The right hand is the hand of chesed, of loving kindness. God has a left arm also. That's the arm of judgment. So if we're asking for help, we're asking for mercy, we're asking for kindness, we're not going to appeal to the left arm. We're going to appeal to the right arm. So I just said it was a power of action, but it's the power of a particular action. It's the power of acting out of chesed, out of loving kindness. That's right. That's right. And since that's the purpose of the whole creation, so we're really appealing to the top.
Why is it that we put the phone on, we put on the opposite for a writing term?
Correct. You're absolutely right. Here, I'll just tell you very briefly, it's very interesting. Ben Yonah says that the symbolism in tefillin is consistent throughout. You put it on the head to dedicate your mind to God. You put it next to the heart to dedicate your emotions and will to God. You put it on the arm to dedicate your actions to God. That's what Ben Yonah says. But it is peculiar, that being the case, that the mitzvah, the halacha, is to put it on the weaker arm. So what does that mean? I'm dedicating my weaker actions to God, my stronger actions, keeping for myself. So it's a little peculiar. Now, if you look at your sitter before you put on tefillin, you'll see that the symbolism is different. And this I do recommend, to read that paragraph from time to time. The head is to dedicate the mind to God. The heart is to dedicate the emotions and will to God. And the arm is to remember God's outstretched arm when he took us out of Egypt. I put it on my arm to remember God's arm. It's not a question of dedicating anything about me to God. How do I remember it? Because I put it on my weaker arm. Put it on my weaker arm. And the message is that when I act, I'm playing the weak role. God is playing the strong role. Because God is running the world. He makes things happen. And my contribution through my free will is a very minor contribution. So I put it on my weaker arm to remember that my role in the world is the weaker role. And even in my actions, I don't think we've talked about this when you're here, but even my actions happen when I take a decision in my soul and God manipulates the body to carry it out. So even in my actions, the fact that the body carries out what I've decided in my soul is all God's doing. So it has an entirely different message. Putting it on the weaker arm is an entirely different message. To remember the fact that God's arm is the arm that's running the world.
And where in the center does that be found?
Right before you put on film.
There's a whole
paragraph, right? In this brown book. I agree with it. The meditation before putting on film. one before you put on a towel.